From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. Democrats and Republicans are gearing up for another momentous impeachment trial beginning tomorrow. The two sides are hammering out the details of the unprecedented second trial of former President Donald Trump. We're joined now by NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, we've simply never seen this before in American history. A president impeached twice, the second time after he's left office. How are senators preparing for this occasion?
Well, you know, they're going to be the jury, and we've already seen that 45 Republicans have sided with Senator Rand Paul, who brought this measure forward, that believing that this is unconstitutional for the Senate to even bring it forward. We're going to see tomorrow them starting this trial. We know that the House impeachment managers on the Democratic side are trying to push a shortened case, one heavy on video and emotional pleas from, recalling the events of January 6th to try to make it, something to, almost try the president before the public to convince them rather than just the senators.
I see. And they will be led by Representative Jamie Raskin. And again, the charge is for inciting a riot. Aside from that emotional appeal, I mean, the nuts and bolts, how are they going to make the case?
Are they going to say that the president is singularly responsible, not just based on his rhetoric at the January 6th rally at the Ellipse at the White House when the pro-Trump mob then stormed the Capitol, but also his role in false claims that set the groundwork for this and this false grievance that they had, that that the president had a right to say that there was that the election was stolen from him, even though there was no evidence for that, and that groundswell, that was the whole reason why they were there in the first place, and that the president's responsible for that.
So his culpability is sort of the substance of the case against him, but there's also this procedural point, and as you said, Domenico, 45 Senate Republicans voted to dismiss the trial before it even began, claiming that just from a process standpoint, you can't convict a president who isn't in office anymore. Let's hear Trump ally Lindsey Graham and the way he put it on Face the Nation yesterday.
If you believe he committed a crime, he can be prosecuted like any other citizen. Impeachment is a political process. We've never impeached a president once they're out of office. I think this is a very bad idea.
So, Domenico, he says it's a bad idea. On the other hand, he, like all of these members of Congress, had a very scary experience just last month. So, I mean, do Republicans think Trump should face any consequences then?
Some have called for censure, but on the case of precedent, you know, it's interesting. Lindsey Graham leaves out the case of Ulysses S. Grant's war secretary in 1876, who was tried after he resigned. And the impeachment managers back then thought that this had settled the case because the Senate had voted back then that they did have jurisdiction. Now, it was controversial back then. The Trump lawyers, who have just put out their 75-page brief responding to some of the charges, cite this case and said that, you know, essentially because Belknap wasn't convicted by two-thirds and because most of the senators back then didn't think that they had standing, or most of the senators who voted to acquit him thought that he didn't have standing, that's enough to say it's unconstitutional, even though a majority of the senators voted to convict him. So it was a controversy back then, and it's still a controversy today.
I see. So some details there of the arguments that the former president's defense team is going to make. How about a few other process things, Domenico, in the moment that we have left, because we need other things to get sorted out, like how long the trial is going to take, whether both sides can call witnesses. Where do those things stand?
Yeah, we're not sure how long this is going to go on. All signs are that it could be a week or so. I really think that what's interesting is going to be how the Trump team, how their lawyers go down this path. They're going to make what looks like a narrow constitutional argument that a former president can't be tried and that impeachment is mainly about removal and not disqualification from office. Because if they go down the path of the election fraud, that could shake loose some Republicans. And there was only just a glancing mention of even the election fraud and the president's rhetoric on one line and one page of the 75-page brief.
That's NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thanks.
Hey, you're welcome.
Well, in many places throughout the country, there's a contentious relationship between police and communities of color. Nate Hedgie of Mountain West News Bureau visited one town in Washington state where activists say police are doing things right.
Moses Lake is a hardscrabble, working-class community out in the dry, flat scablands of eastern Washington.
We have a lot of factories out here. A lot of the
Johanna Ben-Wahid is taking me on a tour downtown.
There's a lot of airbag factories.
He's got piercings, dreadlocks, and he's taking drags from a vape pen dangling around his neck. He's lived here in Moses Lake for most of his life. And while the town is kind of diverse,
and we have a lot of Latinos.
Wahid is one of the few black people here, so he was pretty nervous when he helped organize a Black Lives Matter protest in Moses Lake this summer. He says there's a white racist element in town.
It came together nicely. We just had a nice march, snacks, we talked, shared stories. You know what I mean? It went really, really well, which surprised the hell out of me because I get called the N-word around here quite a lot.
And so, while Wahid and others were protesting police violence and systemic racism across the country, he says they weren't worried about the local cops.
Believe me, I'm not a huge fan of the police and stuff like that, but the police here, I do like them.
That's because in Moses Lake, Wahid says the police don't feel like bad guys. They feel like your neighbors.
They're very wholesome. They're very localized. They're very human. They go to our gas stations. They go to our gyms, our stores. You see them on and off duty. So it's really hard to hate them. Bailey, come here.
Wahid hollers out to his friend, Bailey Sampson, who's hanging out near a skate park. She runs over. Sampson was one of the rally co-organizers, and she agrees with Wahid. Unlike in other towns, the cops here, pretty cool.
It's just that they're a part of our community, and I think, like, that's a big deal.
It is a big deal. Many cops don't live in the communities that they serve, especially in larger cities. Now, Moses Lake is relatively small. About 20,000 people live here. It has one of the lowest fatal encounter rates in the country, despite having rates of violent crime that are somewhat higher than the national average. Sampson says the cops here know how to defuse situations.
Instead of just, pulling your gun and being, getting immediately defensive, they kind of want to de-escalate, not escalate the situation. And I think that's a big thing. I think a lot of cops could take a page out of their book at just how to handle people.
Over the past 7 years, there have been 2 officer-involved fatalities in Moses Lake and the surrounding area. Both men were armed, one shot a police dog. Compare that to a similar city, such as Klamath Falls, Oregon, which had twice that number.
If you've got uses of force that are not justified, you got to deal with it. You've absolutely got to deal with it.
That's Kevin Fuhr. He's the police chief in Moses Lake. He says his department keeps close tabs on officers that use any force during an arrest. Fear's a compact, middle-aged man with short gray hair wearing a mask. And we're speaking outside of the station as Canada geese migrate overhead. He's been a cop for about 3 decades. He says a good police department begins with hiring the right people and then training the heck out of them. His 35 officers go through extensive annual training in everything from de-escalation techniques to recognizing any implicit biases they have. He says they also receive 40 hours of crisis intervention training every year. That's 5 times more than what's required by the state.
It's not just giving an officer a gun, a badge, and the tools and the equipment to say, go arrest the bad guys. It's giving them the skills to be able to talk to people, be able to build the relationship. That you, when you show up and you're talking to somebody who's maybe a little amped up, you don't come in amped up. You come in and you try to calm them down.
He calls it talking people into handcuffs. And that appears to work. Last year, the Moses Lake Police Department used force in less than 3% of its arrests. Whenever that number gets too high, Fuhr will take the officers responsible and either work on retraining them or he'll fire them. He also has strict policies for when cops can use physical restraint or lethal force during an arrest. All of these are elements of a good police department. That's according to law enforcement expert Robin Engel.
What you see are strong policies, strong training, and strong supervision and accountability mechanisms.
Engel is research director at the International Association of Chiefs of Police and a criminology professor at the University of Cincinnati. She says you need all these components working together to ensure that a department has low lethal force numbers. But here's the thing. Unlike most other countries, law enforcement training in the U.S. is all over the board.
Agencies vary, literally agency by agency, in terms of not just the quantity of training, but the quality of training.
And this can lead to departments like Moses Lake with low fatality numbers and others that dwarf the 2 deaths here. And that's prompted calls nationwide to take money from law enforcement budgets and put it into social and mental health care services instead. Moses Lake Police Chief Kevin Feuer says he gets where activists are coming from.
You look at these uses of force where an officer has shown up because somebody is in mental health crisis, and maybe that person in mental health crisis has a weapon, and now you've just introduced a law enforcement officer that's carrying a gun that now is worried about somebody coming after them. We shouldn't be going to those.
That's why Feuer has his officers respond to as many of these situations over the phone first.
Because those are the situations that turn bad. Somebody opens the door, they've got a knife in their hand, they lunge at the officer, the officer shoots them. We're not even engaging in those. We're making the phone call, and we're staying out.
Feuer is also working on a new protocol that will route these calls to local mental health groups instead of the police. For Here and Now, I'm Nate Hedgie, reporting from Moses Lake, Washington.
Depending on where you live, the demand for COVID-19 vaccines continues to outpace supply. About 1.4 million Americans are getting shots every day. And some places like West Virginia and Alaska are making steady progress. But CDC data shows other states like Idaho, Missouri, and Iowa are at the end of the pack when it comes to vaccinations. And joining us now to talk about some of the challenges and possible solutions is Dr. Christine Hahn. She's the state epidemiologist for Idaho and also serves as medical director for the Idaho Division of Public Health. Dr. Hahn, welcome.
Thank you.
You've been at this a long time, more than two decades as a health leader. Nationally, how would you describe the vaccine rollout so far?
Well, the rollout, of course, is not as smooth as any of us would have wanted. There were lots of challenges with communication from the federal level. I think those are getting better. And of course, we would have all loved to see more vaccine faster. We know one of our main limiting factors is just the amount of vaccine that is coming out from the manufacturers. And that's just been a real challenge to try to get folks vaccinated when there just isn't enough vaccine yet.
Yeah, what we're seeing is kind of like what we saw with COVID-19 testing. Each state is basically going about the vaccine rollout differently. What stage is Idaho in right now? Who's eligible to get a vaccine there?
We right now have folks 65 and older are all eligible to get the vaccine. But in addition, we've been vaccinating long-term care facilities and healthcare workers, of course. We also have, our governor felt very strongly about having some of our, you know, frontline essential workers high up in the priority groups. So that includes teachers. I know that's been a big topic in many states, and I'm really glad that our teachers have stepped to the front of the line, correction officers and fire, police, that type of folks. So we do have a little bit of a different picture than what you might see in some other states.
In terms of vaccine supply, how has it been going? We're reading that Idaho has about 7.5% of its population receiving at least one vaccine dose.
Yeah, so it's an interesting dilemma. The states are receiving vaccine based on our adult population, not on our total population. Idaho has more children than most other states, percentage-wise. So we're actually getting fewer vaccines per capita than many other states. I think we're 48th right now, just as far as the amount of vaccine we're receiving into our population. So that gives us an extra challenge in trying to, of course, get folks vaccinated. We are getting less vaccine. That said, we're very proud of the way things are going. Idahoans have really been stepping up. We're getting more vaccines out there this last week than we had the week before, and it keeps getting better. But at some point, we just need more vaccine.
Has there been any vaccine hesitancy? Has that been an obstacle at all in the state?
Yeah, you know, Idaho does have a proud, independent, free-thinking population here, and we do have more vaccine hesitancy than I think we have in other parts of the country. We do have one of the highest rates of vaccine exemptions for school children, for example. Idaho has always had a very high rate of exemptions to required vaccines. So we are concerned that vaccine hesitancy is playing a role here. We have heard anecdotally of entire groups turning down, including folks sometimes in the healthcare sector, sometimes turning down the vaccine. Mm. And an opinion poll, a survey that just got publicized last week by Boise State University, showed, and this was taken in December, that only 54% of the population said they would take the vaccine if it was available today. So that's a tough, we have a lot of work to do to educate people, to give them confidence in this vaccine and try to overcome some of those hesitancies and reluctance to get vaccinated.
I know you were saying you're really proud at the pace. In the meantime, what support do you need at this point from the federal government?
Yeah, well, we are so happy to hear of some of the things coming out now. I hear this week CDC is going to be coming out with opening school guidance. We also need more information on the amount of vaccine coming out. We're excited about potentially a third vaccine, but we have no visibility yet. And I've done quite a bit of scouring, and I can't find information on how much vaccine that will add to us. So it's very hard to plan mass clinics and plan increasing vaccination when we have no idea how much vaccine we're actually going to be getting.
How are you holding up in all of this? We just keep hearing that there is light at the end of the tunnel. But I'm thinking about all of the healthcare workers who have been working nonstop to get these vaccines into their regions and states.
This is the hardest thing we've ever been through, and the stress on the staff is unbelievable. It's been very, very hard. And I think the vaccine is giving us that feeling of, okay, we can keep going. It's like when you're running a marathon and you can kind of in the distance see the finish line and people are yelling, "You're almost there." We would love to think we're almost there. I think this would be unsustainable long-term, this type of effort and stress, scrutiny, and challenges is just incredibly hard.
Well, I thank you so much for your work. And I know those in Idaho also thank you. That's Dr. Christine Hahn. She's a state epidemiologist for Idaho and also serves as medical director for the Idaho Division of Public Health. Thank you again.
Thank you, Tanya. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Now to Washington, D.C., where students are back in the classroom for the first time in almost a year. D.C. public schools have been open for in-person learning for about a week. So how's it going so far? Here to tell us is Debbie Trung. She's an education reporter for member station WAMU in Washington. And Debbie, how many students have returned to the classroom?
So D.C. public schools said that they can accommodate about 15,000 students for in-person learning. Of that, 9,500 students actually said that they would show up, and actually fewer ended up showing up on the first day of school last week.
So you spoke with some families about how they made the difficult decision to send their children back to school or not. What did they tell you?
D.C. public schools prioritize bringing back special education students, English language learners, and students in low-income families. At the same time, many of the low-income families here in D.C. are also Black and Hispanic groups of people that have suffered disproportionately during this pandemic. On the one hand, while many of these students may benefit from in-person learning, their families could face some of the hardest consequences if a family member gets sick and can't work, or worse. I spoke with Alexandria Simbana. She herself had COVID last year and has sort of preemptively told her daughter's school that she will not be returning her 8-year-old back to the classroom for the foreseeable future. Alexandra is also in touch with many of the immigrant Spanish-speaking families at her daughter's school, which is Cleveland Elementary. And she said that many of those families are also choosing to keep their families home for exactly those same fears.
They know they're at risk. They know this is detrimental to not only their health, but their financial situations. Top of mind for them is keeping their families alive.
On the other hand, of course, there's the social and emotional benefits of being in a classroom and being around your peers. And so many other parents also said that they were willing to have their children go back so that they could have those richer, in their view, academic and social experiences.
I see. So for those students who have gone back then, Debbie, what does the classroom look like right now? I think that a lot of listeners maybe are in similar positions where their districts are either getting ready to go back and they're listening and wondering, how does it work? Because some students are still learning remotely.
Yeah. So students arrive on a staggered schedule. They have to keep in the same room of 10 or 11 students for the entire school day. Lunch is eaten inside the classroom. There are, of course, all of the safety procedures, social distancing, face mask requirements. And when it comes down to actual learning, in some schools, students are back once or twice a week in person, and they spend the rest of the week virtual. In other classrooms, students may be in the classroom, 4 days a week while a teacher is teaching them, also broadcasting to the rest of the class, which is logging on virtually. it really varies across the school system, but nothing like it was pre-pandemic.
No, and it took a long time to get to this point, right? Because there has been months of contention between the school district and its teachers. Just last Monday, the D.C. public school system actually requested that a judge grant a temporary restraining order against the teachers' union to avoid a potential strike. So how many teachers have returned, Debbie, and how are they feeling?
So for context, about 4,200 staff members were expected to return last week. About 2,200 of those were teachers. And while there were some teachers who volunteered to return to the classroom, the majority did not. And so they were required to go into in-person teaching, even if they didn't necessarily feel comfortable doing that. And teachers have had the opportunity to get the first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. But there were a lot of teachers who were pushing to delay the start of reopening until they could get that second dose. And obviously that didn't happen. And DC Public Schools has provided personal protective equipment. They've updated ventilation and HVAC systems. But, you know, many teachers expressed to me that they've long had a mistrust in the school system, and it's hard to bridge that in this moment when there's so much at stake.
So as you say, most students are continuing to learn remotely. Do we expect that to keep up, Debbie, or is the district expecting that more students in the coming weeks will trickle back in and other schools ready to handle a scaled up in-person learning environment?
I definitely think that more students will show up in the coming weeks. And right now, 9,500 students are expected to be back in person. The school system says it can accommodate many thousands more.
Yeah, like every district, D.C. is learning how to do learning in an entirely new world. Debbie Truong is an education reporter for member station WAMU. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Scott.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a Master's in Engineering and Management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Tuesday, February 9th from noon to 1 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
My name is Peter Sagal, and I'm here to interrupt your very serious NPR podcast to tell you about another NPR podcast, mainly mine, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Chances are that right now you're enjoying an earnest, serious treatment of some serious topic in the news or perhaps history or science. That's great, really. Well, that's not what we do, because people cannot live on Sirius alone. Listen now to the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me podcast from NPR.
Doing your taxes can be a pain, but you could get a bigger refund if you file on time this year. That's because many of the coronavirus relief provisions are hidden in your tax return. Our personal finance expert, Jill Schlesinger, is here to explain what to look out for. She's the CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Hey, Jill.
Hello.
Okay, so tax season officially begins this Friday, and the deadline to file your return with the IRS is April 15th. And there's been this call for people to ditch the paper and file their returns electronically if they can. Why is that?
Well, first of all, every single year, the IRS says, look, electronic filing, it's the safest, most accurate, and the fastest way to get a refund. And about 85 or 90% of people do get refunds. So that's number one. But number two, remember, if you had it filed electronically, you got your stimulus checks much faster than those who had to wait weeks, sometimes months for their money. So let's ditch the paper together. Come on, pinky swear with me. Let's do electronic filing.
Yeah, I've been doing it for a few years. Okay. So on the issue of relief checks, a significant number of Americans who qualified for them under the first relief package passed last March still have not received their money. That's really hard to believe, but it's true. How can filing your taxes this year actually ensure you get the money and future direct payments from the government?
The government knows it didn't have every bit of information about every taxpayer. And so as a result, there is something new this tax filing season. It's called the Recovery Rebate Credit. Line 30 on your Form 1040, gang. And this is very important because there's a lot of people who say not only maybe they didn't get their checks last year, or maybe they said, hey, it wasn't what I thought it would be. Maybe it wasn't $1,200, or maybe you missed a kid because I had a baby late in the tax season. So in order to make sure you get all of your money, you've got to file your taxes. The Recovery Rebate Credit could unlock those stimulus dollars for you.
Okay. There's something else. If you received unemployment benefits last year, you could actually owe taxes depending on which state you live in. The IRS is also warning Americans about this massive unemployment scam that could impact folks when they file their tax return. What's going on and how can people find out if they've actually been targeted?
Well, first of all, let me just tell everybody who got unemployment benefits, it's taxable at the federal level, no matter what, whether it's a state or a federal plan. So you got to know that. You'll get Form 1099-G. There are 15 states that don't levy taxes on unemployment at the state level. Now, here's the thing about that 1099-G. This is where you're going to figure out if someone scammed you. This actually happened to my sister this week. She called me up and she says, I got this crazy tax document from the state of New York saying that here's the money I got from unemployment. Well, she wasn't unemployed. Someone got a hold of her tax ID number, filed for unemployment benefits. The only way you know if someone's done that is if you've gotten that 1099-G. And wow, it's crazy making. But remember, if you get this, the easiest thing to do is you contact the issuing state agency. You say, look, I need a revision. I didn't get those benefits. You probably should also let the IRS know, get an identity protection PIN for you, just because now your social's out there. So be careful about that one.
Jill Schlesinger is CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. As always, thank you.
Take care.
More than 40 million doses of coronavirus vaccines have been administered in the U.S. so far, but to end the pandemic, we'll need to vaccinate a substantial portion of the global population, not just Americans. So we want to check in now on how that effort is going in the rest of the world. And to do that, we have three NPR correspondents with us. China correspondent John Ruich. Hi, John.
Hi there.
Rob Schmitz is in Berlin. Hi, Rob.
Hello.
And Ader Peralta is in Nairobi. Hello, Ader.
Hey there.
Let's start with you, Ader, in Africa. You know, today in South Africa, which has the highest number of cases and deaths on the continent, they've halted the rollout of a much-anticipated AstraZeneca vaccine after a study, which we should mention has not yet been peer-reviewed, suggests the vaccine isn't as effective against the South African coronavirus variant. So how big a blow is that to efforts to fight the pandemic there?
It's huge. I mean, just last week, people were celebrating. President Cyril Ramaphosa was at the airport receiving the first 1 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine. I mean, the shipment itself got a hero's welcome. It was broadcast live on national TV. As you said, you know, South Africa has suffered tremendously during this pandemic, and the vaccine was seen as a hope that the country could emerge from it. And now, those vaccines are on hold because of the study that you mentioned. It was small, but it found that the AstraZeneca vaccine, the only vaccine that South Africa had received, did not prevent mild to moderate illness caused by this new variant that is dominant in South Africa. And that same study also found that the new variant was able to reinfect South Africans who had already suffered from the original coronavirus. So South African scientists gave a pretty grim assessment of the future. They said that this variant is a wake-up call, that vaccines are not the panacea. They said that we're likely to live with this virus for the rest of our lives, and we should change our expectations. We shouldn't expect, they say, that vaccines will end this pandemic, but maybe they can prevent severe disease and maybe keep people out of hospitals.
And there's understandable frustration there. South Africa's president, who until recently was the chair of the Africa Union, has accused rich countries of hoarding vaccines. So, Ader, how far behind is Africa when it comes to rolling out COVID vaccines?
Super, super behind. Only one country in sub-Saharan Africa has started giving out vaccines, and those were very few, like 50 of them. And look, This South African variant is thought to be spreading throughout the continent, and that is worrying because COVAX, which is a program to get vaccines to poorer countries, the vaccine they are distributing most widely is that AstraZeneca one. And if you look at that distribution schedule, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine or the Novavax vaccines, which do have some effectiveness against the South African strain, those will not start rolling out via this scheme in any significant numbers until the third quarter of this year.
Yeah, a lot of caveats there. And even that best case scenario leaves some room for improvement, to say the least. Rob, let's turn to Europe, though, because the continent had promised to make vaccines equally available to all of its 27 member states. But now it's lagging behind both the U.S. and the U.K. It's even embroiled in a trade dispute with Britain over supply of the AstraZeneca vaccine that we were just discussing. So what is going on there?
Yeah. Note to self, when you insist on securing hundreds of millions of doses of vaccines for 27 countries, do it early and make sure those whom you're ordering from can follow through. The EU leadership did not do these things. And as a result, European countries are far behind the US and the UK in vaccinating their citizens. Much of the blame is focused on Ursula von der Leyen. She's the president of the EU Commission. And she was the one who early on persuaded the EU's member states to let her and the EU bureaucracy take care of securing vaccines. The EU agency that approves vaccines took far too long to do its job. That's part of the reason that AstraZeneca could not deliver on its order to the EU. And when it became clear that the Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna vaccines were ahead of the others in their trials, the EU didn't bother to change gears and order more of those vaccines. The UK has administered 18 doses per 100 people. The US is at 12 doses per 100. Compare that to just 4 doses per 100 Spaniards, Germans, and Italians, and you've got a lot of Europeans who feel like they're being left behind.
Well, what's the effect of that then, Rob? Because some of those countries that you just mentioned were among the hardest hit in the world. So how bad are things now?
Things are bad. The new coronavirus variants from the UK and the one we just talked about with Adar from South Africa have spread throughout the continent by now, and these are more transmissible mutations of the virus, and it's left some countries' healthcare systems totally overwhelmed. I think it's helpful to look at the incidence rate, that is, how many individuals are infected per 100,000 people over the past week. Currently, that number in Portugal and Spain is more than 400, and by comparison, the number for the U.S. right now is 247. So Portugal, Spain, Czech Republic, and other Eastern European countries, these are the big hotspots in the EU at the moment. Germany, where I am, has managed to get its incidence rate under 80 with its latest lockdown, but it's been a struggle. For much of Europe, the vaccine is sorely needed right now.
You know, one other point of comparison, of course, is China. And we just recently heard the French president, Emmanuel Macron, addressing the Atlantic Council. And he said that China's vaccine effort is a clear diplomatic success and added that that's a little bit of humiliating for us. And he and German Chancellor Angela Merkel have said they actually would use vaccines from Russia or China if the EU approved them. Could that actually happen, Rob? And if so, what would that tell you about the state of vaccine rollouts in Europe?
Well, theoretically, it could happen, but here's why it might not happen. The European Medicines Agency, which is in charge of approving vaccines for the EU, typically takes around 2 months to approve a vaccine. So that could be maybe spring before that happens. And by then, the great European vaccine shortage may very well be a thing of the past. You know, BioNTech is a German company, and it's scheduled to open a massive production facility in Germany for its vaccine with Pfizer by the end of this month. And that will greatly increase the number of doses for the EU. It's likely that by then, AstraZeneca and Moderna's vaccines will be more readily available, too. So it's a big question whether the Chinese and Russian vaccines will actually be administered here.
All right. Well, and John Ruich, I want to come to you for the latest on what's going on in China. We just heard that European leaders are calling that effort a success. And the timing is important because this weekend marks the Lunar New Year, which is a major holiday in East Asia and usually sees a lot of travel. So how has China been stepping up its vaccine drive to prepare for that?
Yeah, China did really well at getting the pandemic under control and developing vaccines quite quickly, but the rollout has been slower than a lot of people expected. By the middle of last week, there were just north of 31 million shots that had been administered, prioritizing healthcare and transport sectors. They've set a goal of 50 million shots by the Lunar New Year, which is this coming Friday. They may miss that target. Either way, it's a tiny fraction of the population of 1.4 billion people. So the government is taking other steps. You know, Lunar New Year, as you say, it's a huge travel season in China. Hundreds of millions of people traditionally hit the road. And that's a nightmare from a disease control standpoint. So the government's trying to limit travel. They're requiring COVID tests for some travelers and quarantines. They're encouraging migrant workers, the backbone of this blue-collar labor force, to stay put during the Chinese New Year, not go home, which is a big ask. And in some places, giving out cash, so they'll do so. The Chinese equivalent of Netflix, this streaming service called iQIYI, is actually offering free access in some areas so people can enjoy themselves a little bit, despite not doing what they'd normally be doing at this time of year.
As incentive, you can sit home and stream for free, I suppose. So that's what's going on in China. But what about the rest of the region? I mean, Japan, South Korea, Hong Kong, they're all moving much more slowly. In fact, South Korea, for example, isn't going to start vaccinating people over 65 until May. Is that because of a supply problem?
Well, supply is part of it. I mean, both countries have done well at controlling the pandemic. In South Korea's case, they've been a model, but they were slow out of the gate with vaccines. The government didn't start to enter into purchase negotiations until late into the fall. So they've got a plan now. They're gathering doses from various sources. Reportedly, they have over 100 million doses now, which is going to be enough to inoculate their population of 52 million people. They're starting to administer them this month, and the government's aim is to have more than 30 million people vaccinated by September. For Japan, the big preoccupation is the Summer Olympics. You'll recall that it was postponed from last year. It's scheduled to start in late July. The government there wants everyone vaccinated ahead of time. They have 126 million people, and they're starting next week, but they've also caught flack for being slow off the mark with vaccines. Japan is the last G7 country to get the ball rolling.
Really sort of have two back-to-back in a way, because as you say, you've got Tokyo planning to come up this summer, and then before we know it, Beijing 2022 for the Winter Olympics will be here as well. That's NPR China correspondent John Ruich. We've also been speaking with NPR's Rob Schmitz in Berlin and NPR's Ada Peralta in Nairobi. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking a lot lately about the role of technology in our lives as lawmakers renew calls for regulation and social media companies announce new plans to police misinformation. Tristan Harris has been talking about all of this for years. He's co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology and was featured in the film The Social Dilemma. He's now a co-author of a new anthology called The New Possible: Visions of Our World Beyond Crisis. And Tristan, I want to ask you some big questions that you take on in the book. But first, Facebook set up an independent oversight board to address some of the problems you and others have called out. Does that tell you anything about where these tech companies are headed?
That's a great question, Tanya. I mean, I think we're in this really awkward phase where, especially post, you know, the January 6th events and then the fall, the deplatforming of President Trump and many other accounts, people are wondering, wait a second, these tech companies have a lot of power. So we're in this weird middle place where I think we're recognizing that we are now a digital nation. We're now a digital democracy in the sense that more and more of what it means to live life in this country takes place not in the physical world, but in the digital world. You know, the information that we consume or our ability to make money, which is increasingly through these digital platforms. So as what it means to be a citizen shifts into these digital platforms, they have to actually serve and be responsible and accountable in democratic ways. So to your question, Facebook has this oversight board, which is, think of it like a Supreme Court of this digital nation that Facebook stood up. But if you think of it, they have way more court cases that are getting thrown at that body than they have the ability to make decisions, right? I mean, if they're managing something like 15 billion messages per day, they took down in one three-month period 2 billion fake accounts. And so one of the problems is that they've just created a system of harms, of kind of pollution, where there are more types of pollution than there are court cases to adjudicate what would work here. So I think we're in this awkward middle phase of how do we become a digital democracy? And I've called for something almost like a digital constitutional convention, because we also don't want these platforms to be autocratically decided by, you know, Jack Dorsey waking up one day from an island in Tahiti and saying, you know, off goes Trump.
You also say that we can't do it alone. I mean, these tech companies have to help us because we are now addicted to the way that they operate. Do you think that more regulation is the way? Because now the public sentiment towards Silicon Valley has grown even more skeptical. But realistically, what do you think we might see out of Washington that you'd view as progress?
You know, we definitely need to change their core business models. I mean, for people just to understand that, so long as not just the business model, but the design is fundamentally about unchecked virality. You know, being able to broadcast to BBC scale across the world, but having the source of that voice be not a, you know, Walter Cronkite type character who's earned that trust and can broadcast hopefully responsibly. Instead, we have essentially human emotions that are wired directly up to megaphones. And that's the decoupling that's been missing from technology. And we may need regulation to get there. And when we say that, I think people naturally say, well, I don't want the government regulating speech. And I want to be really clear, that's not the kind of regulation here that we're talking about. We're talking about regulation that changes the incentives so that these companies don't profit from the problem, from unregulated messages where, as we say in the film, you know, fake news spreads six times faster than true news. So we need this kind of mass cleanup of our attention commons, of our information commons, just like climate change, from this kind of mass pollution that we've allowed to happen up until now.
People are listening to this conversation we're having right now, and they're thinking, okay, what is the takeaway message? I leave this conversation understanding that technology has now infiltrated our lives in such a profound way. There are these small things that we can do, but are we just too intertwined with technology, with our lives and societies? Can we actually live a life where we're using technology responsibly?
So the interwovenness is really what forces us to kind of have this recognition that we've become kind of a cyborg society. You know, can a business actually survive without using micro-targeted Facebook or Google ads? You know, most businesses now do a lot of their primary advertising through those systems. It's not a Luddite question of we just have to unplug. And we really want, when we talk about the phrase humane technology, is a world where we are not the product, we are the customer, and technology is not in any way have an incentive to control us, but instead is subservient to empowering us and allowing us to free up our minds to do the things that are most important. And that's what I appreciate about, you know, everyone pulling together this book of essays, is we really do need visions of hope right now. You know, more than ever, we can't just sit in the problem. We have to ask on a daily basis, what would it take for this to go well, and how can my actions today be part of that? And that's at least the guiding principles that I try to live by personally. But more and more people are waking up to the fact that we've been part of a toxic hypnotic spell for something like 10 years now of society being sent through the washing machine of these news feeds. And we now have to kind of wake up. But like a hypnotist, you just snap your fingers and all you have to do is realize it.
Okay, Tristan Harris is optimistic. I'm optimistic. Tristan Harris is a co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology and co-author of the new anthology, The New Possible, Visions of Our World Beyond Crisis. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thanks so much, Tanya.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. This is Here and Now.